you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to The Phantom Files. We're a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zachrin, the features editor here at Sci-Fi Wire, and I'm joined again by my good pal and co-host, Emily Gaudette, who is a pop culture reporter at Newsweek. Emily, what's up?
Hey, Jordan. How's it going?
Oh, you know. Welcome back.
Thanks.
Yep. How's life?
It's good. I am back in the world of the living. I was snowed in with the rest of New York yesterday.
I'm still dead. I'm like still sick.
Oh no.
I've been sick for like the last 12 episodes.
Yeah, last time I saw you, 12 episodes.
Yeah. The majority of this run has been me sick, trying not to cough.
I think that's chronic.
Yeah, that's right. I may be dying.
Yeah.
Good. So you're going to Mount Airy Lodge this weekend. I just want the world to know.
Oh, God.
Well, people have listened to this. You've already been there. So you can't like go stalk Emily at Mount Airy Lodge.
Yeah. Oh, true.
But I'm jealous.
Don't come looking for me. You have literally been talking about the Mount Airy Lodge old commercial the whole time I've known you. And every time I was like, ha, 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 yes. And didn't connect the synapses in my brain to remember that I've been to Mount Airy like a ton of times.
Well, for like a reason. You don't just go there for like fun.
Oh, yeah. So my grandparents are extremely successful business people who live in the Poconos. And they really are. And every time they have something to celebrate, they hold a gala at Mount Airy Lodge.
How long have they been doing this?
Since I was a kid. Like, I've only been to one wedding in my life, but I've been to so many of these formal events.
All you have to bring is your love for everything. Do you remember those commercials?
No, I know them from you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the best. I really urge anyone to go look up Mount Airy Lodge. In fact, we're going to play
it is funny.
We're going to play that commercial, part of it, right now.
Beautiful Mount Airy Lodge, all you have to bring is your love of everything.
How good is that?
You know, we didn't have to pause because we're going to edit it.
I pretended we played it because we're going to play it. When you hear this podcast, it'll be in there.
Yeah. No, it's great. It's so good. And like the visuals, please look it up. Because there's this shot where a lady in a really high cut, like 80s bathing suit gets out of the pool and is already in her hotel room. And her husband just like coats her in a towel.
Yeah.
And the room in that commercial must smell horrible. Like chlorine.
Oh, man. Yeah. And like chlorine and then just body fluids because you know that they're doing weird stuff in there.
Yeah, so this is the first time my boyfriend's coming with me to one of these galas.
Well, maybe they'll have the pool in the room.
Yeah, or we'll be in like the Pocono honeymoon suite.
Oh boy, like with a heart-shaped tub.
And mirrors on the ceiling.
Yeah. Oh boy. Well, Emily.
Yes.
What is the geekiest thing you did this week?
Okay, I have two. Okay. So one, speaking of my boyfriend Cam, he is obsessed, like many other people, with this game Fortnite.
Mm.
So he's been playing literally every night. If we have a spare minute, like if we're like, oh, let's make chicken for dinner. I'm like, oh, I got to defrost it. I'll just put it in some cold water in the sink. He's like, oh, well then I'm going to play some Fortnite.
He's telling you to make these ridiculously complicated dinners so you can play Fortnite.
Yes. Anytime there's a moment, if I'm like, I'm going to jump in the shower, I turn the water on and I'm like shampooing and I can hear the music. Anyway, I have been looking up tips for him because he's only won the game once,
okay,
as far as I know, and he's not interested in like any of the loot or the customization, and I am. And so I'm looking up ways to improve his gameplay for him.
That's very generous of you.
Yeah, but he doesn't know that.
Oh.
Okay, so second thing, I did a video at my job with Newsweek explaining the MCU as fast as I could.
Oh, cool.
And they had me they were like, when you introduce Thanos, do an impression of Thanos.
So, let me hear it.
No. A silent impression of Thanos. So like it's me saying, so there's this scary purple guy in space and he turns around and he's like, Earth, what? So they're going
to actually what happens in the movie too.
Yeah, they're going to put like my voice over a shot of me slowly turning over my shoulder and grinning at the camera. But there were three producers in the room with me, and they were like, "No, no, scarier. He's scary. He's scary." So I'm like doing a weird grimace. Anyway, that's the nerdiest thing I did today. Try to do a Josh Brolin impression.
I mean, look, everyone has a Josh Brolin impression.
In their pocket.
I've always said. Yeah, that's a party trick for me. I'm Josh Brolin, and Mother's Day is my favorite impression.
You saw Mother's Day?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I just make a joke about Mother's Day.
Okay. What was the geekiest thing you did?
Well, you know, this week I have been I've been falling down a bit of a Godzilla rabbit hole again. Surprise,
every
surprise.
Week with you.
Yeah, you know what it is? Mm-hmm. I like Godzilla. Well,
yeah.
No,
there
here's
you go.
What it is. I was asked to write a script about Godzilla for work for sci-fi.
Oh, cool.
Like seven Godzilla, like must-watch Godzilla movies. There are like 30 of them. So this is not easy to do, to come up with just seven. I mean, there's a lot of bad ones, to be fair.
Oh, seven to watch.
Yeah.
I thought you said seven most watched. I was like, how on earth are you finding that out?
Well, I canvassed all of Japan. I did a lot of interviews. No, and so I've been doing a lot of Godzilla research, and I found a book that they sold. Also, I've been going to this rabbit hole, the Toho store online.
I love their Twitter account.
That's the best.
It's so good.
They have a store in Japan that's like devoted to Godzilla and Friends, but you can't buy anything in America. Like, you can't have it shipped to America. Like, I found the $500 Godzilla baseball glove.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, that's why you were, okay.
Yeah, and so I found that, and I was like, I really wanted it. I wasn't going to buy it, but I was going to buy something else because, like, I don't have $500, let alone for a Godzilla baseball glove.
Sure.
But I did find on eBay these special books that they were selling. They showed the special effects, how the movies were made.
Special books.
Yeah, special books with special effects. And so I just ordered it. It's coming in next week, hopefully, or the week after.
Cool.
It's coming from Japan on eBay on the making of the first Godzilla in both Japanese and English.
Cool.
I'm only going to be reading the English part, to be fair. Like, it's like Isle of Dogs. It's in they have Japanese, but no subtitles.
Yeah, yeah. That's part of the problem for a lot of people.
Yeah, so... That is a geeky thing that I did this week, falling down another Godzilla rabbit hole. I've also been watching Cowboy Bebop a lot because...
oh, that's so exciting.
The anniversary is coming up.
For the first time?
This is my first time, yeah.
Cool.
Because I interviewed Mike Daniels last week, and that was a fun interview, and he recommended Cowboy Bebop. And I've seen some, but the anniversary, the 20-year anniversary or something like that is coming up next week.
That's one of those shows I wish I could go back and watch for the first time. That and, like, Arrested Development.
Yeah, well, speaking of TV writers, our guest this week is one of the most powerful voices in geekdom these days. Mark Bernardin is a writer of comic books, TV shows, and great columns, some of which I am lucky enough to edit every so often. You'll recognize his voice from Kevin Smith's Fat Man on Batman podcast. Mark Bernardin, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
Doing well. I'm really excited we got you on the show.
Whee!
And you are in transit now, right?
I am indeed. I pulled off the road because I want to be able to give my full concentration to this. I don't want to be dodging crappy LA drivers who do not know how to drive in the rain because, you know, water falling from the sky is an oddity on the West Coast.
That's much more consideration than most of our guests give us. So I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So basically what we do when we start here is, we kind of go through the origin story of our guests geekdom. So why don't we start, you know, when did you become a geek? What were you like as a kid? Let's get deep.
The first, one of my very first memories is when I was 6 years old and I saw Star Wars in the theater. Like I remember distinctly the feel and the sound of the opening crawl and the Star Destroyer screaming over your head and chasing down a blockade runner. It is one of my first memories, and I think that was in a very real way the moment that I began to self-identify as a nerd. You know, and I identified as a nerd, I think, before I identified as anything else. Mm. You know, I grew up in the Bronx in the 70s, and most of the kids on my block, you know, looked a little bit like me, you know, maybe a little lighter, a little bit darker.
Sure.
But, you know, we were all people of color. And so the thing that separated me from them was my love for Godzilla and Kiss and Star Wars and comic books in a way that they didn't quite share. And that just sort of became, in a way, the person who I was, and the way that I entered the world was I entered the world as a nerd.
Did you keep it a secret because other kids didn't like it?
You know, I had like the one close friend who was also as crazy about, you know, Battlestar Galactica and Knight Rider as I was. But, you know, the 70s and 80s were a not particularly welcoming time for almost everything.
Right.
So yeah, there was a lot more, you know, like waiting to find the people you would stumble into in the comic book store and share the stolen glances of, oh, you're here too? Oh yeah, man, that's awesome. Okay, cool. What else do you do that I might like?
I feel like even in the 90s when I was coming of age, I was not, I mean, I don't think it was cool yet to be a geek. I mean, I remember going to comic book stores and not seeing my friends, and I played, like, when I was a little kid, we played like Ninja Turtles, and then once you get to like second grade, it was like, all right, enough of that. And so I think the being a geek, being a cool thing, is very relatively new.
Yeah, it kind of is. Like, you know, I'm not going to say that I was like an out and proud nerd, but I also don't think I kept it that much of a secret. You know, like I was wanting to be making comic books when I was in high school and had like a crew of people in like the artsy crew who would like help me make these really, really bad comic books that I don't actually have, you know, access to anymore. I don't know if anybody mm-hmm. does. But that sense of, I mean, you found your tribe. That's always what high school is. You've got to find your tribe. Unless you're lucky enough to be Ferris Bueller, who's a member of every tribe.
Right. Emily was a theater kid.
You know,
yeah, I was. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Good for you. I love the theater kids.
Theater kids were cool. They were a catch-all, though. Like, we had all the dregs from different groups.
I know. It's why I like the theater kids. Like, I used to build sets for the theater crew. Mm-hmm. And it was always like, you know, the Island of Misfit Toys, but in the best possible way.
When did you know that you were going to be able to make a living as a geek? Like, when was your first break?
I mean, it's funny because everything that I had sort of done professionally was in the geek world. Mm-hmm. My first job out of college was working for a magazine called Starlog Magazine, which doesn't exist anymore.
R.I.P.
But R.I.P. But like, they started in the mid-70s based around the interest in Star Trek conventions. And, you know, they were one of the first periodicals devoted to like nerd pursuits. And you know, they also published Fangoria, which is still, you know, thankfully back from the dead. But
fitting
like my first, the first, yeah, I mean, the first check I ever got was for covering nerd stuff. And then when I went to Entertainment Weekly, I went there and they kind of wanted me there because I was a nerd and because they realized that we were starting to get into a phase where even back in like the mid-90s, when it's like, all right, well, there's this Blade movie that people seem to like, and then they made a Spawn movie, and then, oh, Spider-Man came out, and, oh, hey, X-Men's here, and then Matrix is here, and then the idea that Entertainment Weekly was always a place that collected nerds of every stripe. I just was their comic book and science fiction nerd, but they had like a legal thriller nerd, and they had a Stephen King nerd, and they had a soap opera nerd, and they had a reality TV show nerd. I was their prototypical nerd.
It's so funny to me because I remember I always liking this stuff. Spider-Man was my favorite. I love Star Wars, and I'm a huge Godzilla fan, but I remember like being in high school being like, you can't make a living doing that thing. You have to like figure out how you're going to go to college and work in whatever you choose to do, some mm-hmm. sort of serious. But now, the more shit you know about this stuff, the better you will be at a well-paying job.
It's ridiculous that what was once useless information is now coin of the realm.
Oh yeah, especially as an editor, I like covet. I like as an editor, I covet people that know that stuff. I mean, I know a decent amount myself, but the depth of information is so valuable.
Yeah, just find me somebody who loves it more than anything else in the world, and they are for me. You know, I will ride for you. Where are we going? What do you mean? Let me help.
No, you mentioned Starlog. One of our old colleagues at Inverse, this guy Ryan Britt, he wrote a long story about a Starlog last year that I edited, and he was a little bit older than me, so he had grown up reading Starlog as well. And they talk about the sheer amount of like set visits and opportunities and scoops that they got that no one necessarily, there was no competition for it, and it seems absurd now that every single thing is so closely guarded, but that stuff would just pass around like it was nothing back in the day.
yeah, like if you know, you would have to maybe once or twice have to deal with like Time magazine because Batman was coming out. But beyond that, you know, like Steven Spielberg would give us exclusives because nobody else wanted them.
Wow.
You know, nobody else cared as much about that stuff. Like Howard the Duck, you can have all the Howard the Duck stuff you want because nobody else wants any of it.
I love Howard the Duck.
but yeah, like I remember we did our 200th issue, which was a big commemorative thing, and they had testimonials and letters from like George Lucas and Spielberg and John Carpenter and Joe Dante and just this murderer's row of sort of nerd Hollywood talent. I was like, yeah, like this was where I went for this stuff. It was, you know, this and Foy Ackerman's famous monsters and Fangoria was the only place you could find information about the movies you loved.
That's wild. When do you think that switch happened, having, you know, worked both there and now obviously writing for Hollywood Reporter and Us and so many other places? The switch where, like, people really value it.
I mean, I think it was, you know, the internet. Mm. You know, I remember getting email for the first time where they're like, we're putting this on your computer. What is it? Electronic mail. You know? And, like, you know, the internet being the great sort of democratization of this stuff and Any Cool News and that sort of thing. You know, and then Entertainment Weekly. And then, like, when we were able to convince the powers that be that, hey, there's an audience for this. You know, like, I was the first person who worked in Entertainment Weekly to go to San Diego Comic Con.
Wow.
Now they, like, rent out a hotel.
Yeah.
I know. Like, it was, you know, hey, guys, I've heard about this thing. I think we should go. Like, all right, well, you go and tell us what it's all about.
Ow.
Okay, sure. You know, and like, I think I wrote a 200-word column about my experience at Comic-Con the first year.
What was
it? You know, and then the second year, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was like, what was the first year you were there?
My first year there was 2001.
Okay.
2001. So it was just before, just after Spider-Man had opened.
Okay.
And made, like, you know, $200 million.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the lever that allowed me to convince them. So, like, hey, we should cover comics. Yeah, all right. I guess people like this stuff. Yeah, you should send me to Comic-Con. Yeah, okay. Why not? We don't care.
You know, I want to rewind for a minute. You were, the one thing you wrote for us at Sci-Fi that I really loved was talking about being in the Star Trek writer's room early on as, like, an intern.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
In between, it was phenomenal. I mean, it was the summer between my junior and senior year of college, and I had entered some screenplay competition and won, and the grand prize was a summer in Los Angeles working on the Paramount lot on, you know, two television shows. One of them was a show called Brooklyn Bridge that was sponsored by Ubu Productions, which threw the competition, and then the other was, like, to be named later.
Huh.
And it just so happens that the dude who ran Ubu was also best friends with Rick Berman, who ran Star Trek. And I wrote a Star Trek spec because that's the only show that I was watching regularly. And you have to have a television spec to enter the competition. And they're like, all right, well, do you want to go work on Star Trek? Yes, I do. Don't even finish your sentence. I totally want to go. I wrote this spec, this Next Generation spec about Khan returning to the 25th century that was. So it was Khan versus Picard, basically.
You still have a copy?
Which, somewhere, I think I do, like, just on paper, just hard copy. Because I think I wrote it on the kind of computer that did not actually have discs.
Oh, well, so how did that, what?
Yeah, like, it was one of those, like, the computer is remembering it. The onboard memory of the computer is all that, like, the hard drive of, like, a typewriter plus.
Wow.
Wow.
And I think, yeah, and so I think I have one hard copy of it somewhere.
Who was it that wrote a thing of The Simpsons? Was it a spec of The Simpsons? Was it Judd Apatow or someone? And they made it like 20 years later? I'm trying to remember.
It would not surprise me.
Yeah.
They made it. Judd.
Yeah. I think that's what it was. Like 20 something years later, they found it. So that summer must have been crazy awesome, especially being a college kid working on the set of Star Trek.
That's insane.
Like, you know, I wasn't old enough to drink yet, but I'm living by myself for a summer in Los Angeles. And it was amazing. It was a ride. It was getting to learn, getting to see how TV works kind of from the inside, getting to see how you build a show from the ground up. Like, they were doing Deep Space Nine. It was the very first season of DS9. So what's the show going to be? Who's the cast going to be? How do we tell these stories for 22 of these? You know, what are the themes you want to play with? What are the mistakes we're going to make now to recover from what was like a fair to middling science fiction experiment to, for my money, the best Star Trek show we've ever had. Mm. You know, watching how they pivoted from sort of cul-de-sacs of error to avenues of glory was kind of amazing.
Did you keep in touch with them and talk to them about how they were doing it?
You know, every now and again, I would you know, send a letter or a phone call to the showrunner, Ira Stephen Bear. You know, he would always invite me to pitch ideas. Like, hey, man, you know a guy in here now. If you got anything, just let me know. And I didn't have anything, so I never let him know. but yeah, like, and then 20 years after that experience, Ira was running Alphas, and Ira hired me to the Alphas writing staff.
Mm.
And he was that guy.
It must be an interesting transition, writing about it for all this time and then getting on to do the show. Did you take a long time? Did you write a lot of spec scripts? Did you work really hard to become in a writer's room, or did you sort of fall into it?
I mean, it was definitely a long time overnight success. You know, in the, like, there, by the time I got staff, there were three or four pilots that I'd written, most of which were bad, because that's how that song goes. They're supposed to be bad if they're your first. You know, but the benefit of, at that point, having like 15 years as an entertainment journalist, and those are somewhat transferable skills. You know, the idea of being able to write quickly and on deadline, the idea of being able to collaborate with lots of people, the idea of not being precious about the work you do because there is going to be somebody above you who's going to change all of it. You know, those things are valuable in a writer's room, especially the ability to write under duress, especially the ability to be able to just crank out pages. What do you need? When do you need it? How can I help?
Do you remember having any misconceptions that were proven wrong quickly, like as a newbie in the writer's room?
I never realized precisely how much food there was.
Okay.
You know, like if an army runs on its stomach, a writer's room runs on its snacks, and nobody told me that I would gain like 30 pounds working in a writer's room because you were sitting around a table for 10 hours a day eating and talking, which is not a particularly active lifestyle. I also don't think that I realized, and nobody can if you only ever watch TV and don't make TV and you know, don't have that much access to the inner workings of it, how much is just made up on the fly. You know, for as much as you have a plan and every showrunner going into a season has an idea of where they want it to go, and here's the themes you want to hit, here's the relationships you want to highlight, here's the plot points we want to get to. But it's a continually evolving beast. And once the story starts firing on all of its cylinders, you're trying to catch up with it, even as a writer. Like, here's where this character wants to go. Here's what this actor is good at.
Mm-hmm.
Here's where they're not good at. Here's where the story is suddenly turning us into. And being able to pivot and adjust and let the story, with, you know, minimal guidance, tell itself. And if you've set up the pieces right, if you've got the right, you know, players in your, on your team, you can trust the story to find its natural course.
Mm.
And I don't think that before I got on a staff, I understood to the level of which that happens.
Well, you wrote comic books for Marvel and DC, and then your own stuff as well. So you obviously knew how story worked, and, you know, letting that write itself, which is a transferable skill.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, the comic stuff is fun. It also has some again, applicable skills, like being able to write dialogue and being able to sort of choreograph action. But comic writing is its own weird bastard form. That's like, you know, half screenplay, half teleplay, half letter to a writer, to an artist, you know, half cinematographer. You know, like, what you're doing as a comic book writer is selecting moments in your story you want to tell, because
right,
you don't have any motion. You're literally saying, here are these snapshots of story that are the most important to get the story told. And no other form of art requires you to do that. To be like, all right, I know exactly what the story is. Here's the 24 pages worth of it that I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. And there's math involved. Like, you've got to decide, you know, especially if you're writing a full script, How many panels are on a page? How many balloons are in a panel? How many words are in a balloon?
Mm.
What feels right rhythmically? Like, does having more panels on a page feel faster or slower? Does, you know, how do you use the turning of the page to propel story and create cliffhangers and tension and all that stuff you don't have to do as just like, I'm writing prose. Or, you know, Billy walks across the room and he picks up a cup and he takes a sip and, oh my God, it's poison, he falls down. Like, if you're writing a comic book, it's which 8 still pictures will tell that story. And that is a hard thing to do if you've never done it before.
Mm-hmm. And you also, I mean, and I don't, you don't even mean to read your resume to you, but, you know, you wrote your own stories like in, you know, Genius as a full miniseries. And then there's also the continuous stuff you can do for like DC or Marvel. So it's its own thing where you get to make up the story yourself, or you get to sort of, you have to play into what's been going on.
Yeah. I mean, you know, writing for work for hire, if you're writing a superhero for Marvel or DC, it is like writing a sitcom, which is you pick up these toys, you play with them for 22 pages, and then you put them down exactly as you left them. You know, like, 9 times out of 10, you do not get to decide, oh, you know, we're going to kill Wolverine in this issue. No. No, you're not. You're going to leave him exactly where he was. You know, unless you are in the inner circle, unless you're Brian Michael Bendis or Tom King or Scott Snyder, you are not making giant decisions about, you know, what is happening to these characters. So it's, what story can I tell that does not require any character movement whatsoever?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, the character moves over 7 seasons of Friends are microscopic compared to where characters will go from one episode of Battlestar to the next.
Yeah.
Right. You know, like, how has Phoebe changed over the entire run of Friends? Not at all. You know,
right.
Fundamentally. You know, a couple things have happened here and there, but not really. Whereas, you know, in any given episode of Battlestar, like, what, is Guy Spalter crazy now? Oh, is he a sex priest? Oh, no, he's the president. Okay, sure. All of this is viable.
You know, it's interesting too, because this, well, what I'm wondering is how much instruction do they give you? What are the parameters when you're writing work for hire comic book? They tell you what they want the story to be, and you fill in the blanks, or do they say this is where you can go and you can't go?
You know, it depends on the book. You know, sometimes it's like, hey, we'd like you to write, you know, 4 issues of whatever, or we'd like you to write 6 issues of, you know, Static, which I wrote for a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of it is picking up where the previous writer left off and, like, let's continue these threads if you like them, or figure out how to cauterize them and tie them off. And then it's pitching them ideas. Like, here's where I'd like to go. Here's what I'd like to do. Tell me what the boundaries of this sandbox I get to play in are, and then let me tell you what I'd like to do within the sandbox. You know, and then sometimes they will say, okay, we have a giant crossover event planned, so, hey, Static's got to meet Batman in this issue. Figure out a story for that. Like, oh, all right, sure. I can figure out what Static would do if he met Batman. Yeah, I can do that. You know, but it's there is still the idea of, here's the story that I feel comfortable telling. Here's a story I'm passionate to tell. How can I tell this story in a way that does not bump up against any other initiatives you might have, DC or Marvel or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then finding the wiggle room within that to make it your own. You know, there are some books, if you're on, you know, Batman, you might get dictated to. You might be told, hey, listen, you cannot do these 9 things. What would you like to do that aren't these 9 things? All right, figure something out.
Right.
You know, where can he not travel? You're not taking Batman to Bangladesh. All right, well, so we're not going to Bangladesh. Fine. I guess he's going to stay in Gotham. Okay.
Do you have a hero that you haven't been able to write yet that you'd love to?
Do I have a hero? Do I have like a desert island hero?
Yeah.
That I would like to before the end of time get a chance to run. You know, like, I think I would like to write Conan the Barbarian.
Wow. I think, cool.
Conan the Barbarian was the first comic books I ever read. My dad, in his infinite lack of wisdom, decided that a 11-year-old should totally be reading Savage Sword of Conan comic books with all of the nudity and beheadings and sex and violence and crime and theft and all of the awful things that a going boy needs. So there's a love for that character that I have that's deep and pure and infantile and puerile, but I'm still not going to chase it away. So yeah, I would love to take a swing at that. I also kind of like to write Wonder Woman, I think.
Cool.
There's always been something that kind of calls to me about the idea that of the entire Justice League, Diana is the only person who will kill somebody.
Mm-hmm.
She was trained as a warrior. She's got a sword, you know, like that's not a defensive weapon, you know, like she's a soldier who understands that at some point in battle, in combat, if you have to kill a person, you have to kill that person. And I like that is part of what makes her different. Not that it like hyper masculinizes her, but she will do the things that other people won't. She will do the things that everybody won't.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that.
What did you think of the Batman? It was in Batman v Superman. Affleck's Batman killed a few people, right? Cracked their necks.
Yeah, but I think that comes more from a fundamental lack of understanding of who Batman is than a bold decision. In that, like Wonder Woman in her core is a warrior. You know, that is an island filled with warriors who have been holding the line for as long as they can remember. Whereas Batman, you know, his parents were killed by guns, and he's sworn an allegiance to, I will never pick up a gun. Guns are the enemy of the weak. We will not use them. Is literally in a Batman comic book. So to decide that suddenly he's fine with just flinging people into fiery doom feels weird.
Yeah, definitely.
feels like, I don't know what this character is about or what makes him tick. You know, I want to make him the Punisher is basically, a little bit of the Zack Snyder ethos, which was, you know what? He should kill people. Why wouldn't he kill people? Because he's Batman. That's why.
It's really the only reason. Yeah. But they really coded the Batmobile in guns.
Yeah. And he never even gives you like the rubber bullets. Honest. Like these. No, yeah. he's got a tank that's going to blow stuff up. And that's, you know.
Yeah, those movies.
I remember I had a conversation with Greg Rucka about Man of Steel. And I think I convinced him to write a column for me. I think it was for Hollywood Reporter at the time. But it was, there should not be a Superman movie that I cannot take a 12-year-old to go see.
That's fair.
Yeah.
No, we just
if you can't figure out how to make that character work for everybody, then you haven't figured out how to make that character work. Like, why there's a PG-13 Superman movie is boggles the mind.
Well, I think it was coming after that time where Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises came out, and like gritty was more of a style than the style was over substance, I suppose. But those movies made me feel icky. There's like a right wing element to them that made me feel always icky.
There is to Batman a lot of the time, though.
Yeah, but especially like,
yeah,
I mean, it's going to be hard for me to root for a billionaire at any point.
Sure.
You know, like I just not in my makeup to root for a really rich guy.
Yeah. He doesn't even root for himself though.
That's
Batman.
True. Yeah. Like, I relate to his self-loathing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like, or unless he like realizes that he's an asshole, which is Tony Stark. Like, no, I'm the
right.
worst person ever. I'm trying to sort of rehabilitate myself, but I'm still an asshole.
How did you go about, what was the genesis of your original story? After working with all these existing characters, I imagine it's sort of intimidating to sit down and say, okay, and now my work.
I think that there's sort of two kinds of writers, especially who work in comics, which are the people who grew up with these characters and have loved them to death and have always wanted to write them. Mm-hmm. And then the people for whom, you know, they came to comics, especially as I did in the late 80s, early 90s, like the beginning of the indie boom, with like, oh, here's Stray Bullets, and here's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and here's Sin City, and here's, you know, all of this amazing creator-owned work out of DC, and Preacher, and all this stuff. And you're like, well, is there a story, is this a venue for me to tell a story that I've always wanted to tell?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily a story involving, you know, the Justice League. And so I've gotten to like scratch the itch of playing a little bit with the big boy toys, but I've always been more about like, here's kind of the story that I'd like to tell. you know, like the first comics work that I did was a book, the two books that came out in the same month, in the same year, were both original ideas. The Highwaymen that I did for Wildstorm, which is now DC, mm-hmm. and then a book called Monster Attack Network that I did for a tiny publisher called AIT Planet Lar. But they were both like, I grew up loving giant 80s action movies, and I want to do those in comics. So can I? And they said, yeah.
Cool.
Sure.
I'm sure the pitch is a little more difficult than that.
Can I?
It is a little bit more difficult. I had to do a lot of questionable things to get the green light from DC.
Now the secrets come out.
Which basically involved me like somehow getting a hold of Jim Lee's email address.
Awesome.
And then emailing him every week for a year.
Wow.
Telling him that he should let me pitch him a book. Until I realized that I was being an asshole.
Do you think they were just going to spam? Or
you know, no, because here's what happened. Like, I did this. I was an incessant gadfly for a long time. And then I stopped. Because, you know, I was an editor at a periodical, and I would get pitches from freelancers all the time. And the annoying ones would never curry any favor. And the, you know, the smart, like, all right, here's my idea, here's my story, here's what I want to do, here's the access I have, let me do it. You know, okay, sure, let's have a conversation. So the last email I sent Jim was, I've been an asshole. I'm an editor. I get emails all the time from freelancers. If I had a freelancer who acted the way I acted, I would never call them back. So I'm sorry. This will be the last email you ever get from me. Huh. And then he emails me back and says, what do you got?
Get out of here.
Wow.
Yeah. That is like, I'll be in New York in 2 weeks. Let's have coffee.
What?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And here's the thing, though. I will warn everybody. The path to breaking into comics, as was explained to me by Mark Waid, uh-huh. is like breaking out of prison. No two people do it the same way, and they always seal up the hole after you get out.
Yeah.
So do not follow that path of trying to break into comics, because it will not work. Because I was the one who managed to make that work.
Do not harass the publisher.
They've learned. Yeah, do not harass the publisher. They've solved that systemic incoherence, and they figured out a way to never do that again.
You know, I'm very interested in the idea that, like, you were an editor of a periodical. You've had a sort of an illustrious career, Entertainment Weekly and Starlog and all these places. Then you make that jump. Were you worried about that, given, you know, the fact that you cover the industry? How did you navigate that? Because I think a lot of people who are aspiring creatives do what we do, covering the industry, mm-hmm. but also have that creative mm-hmm. side to them. And so that's certainly a difficult thing to navigate. Obviously, you did it well, but how did you do it?
Well, when I was working at EW, you know, they sent me to San Diego, like I said, the first time, and I started to meet a bunch of, you know, editors and publishers and publicists and writers and artists. And, you know, some of them would say to me, you know, time and time again, hey, you're a pretty decent writer. I've read your stuff. You ever think about writing comics? And I would always say, since I was 11, but as long as I cover comics for EW, I cannot write comics for you.
Sure. Mm.
The conflict of interest is too high. And Time Warner, Time Inc. at the time, and still does to a certain degree, even though it's not Time Inc. anymore, but they take the illusion of impropriety as seriously as impropriety itself.
Sure.
You know, the conflict of interest is very real. And so I always had to say no until I finally then went to my bosses and said, I'm going to stop covering comics for you because I want to write them. I will find somebody else to help shepherd your comics coverage. I will hear all my freelancers and all the writers who would write for me, but I want to take a stab at this. And they were really supportive of that because EW understood very early on that, you know, young people, especially young people covering this business would at some point both make contact and build the desire to want to take a shot at it, you know, and for every person who, you know, like me got to, you know, dabble in comics in a small way, or like Gillian Flynn, who was a coworker and a colleague of mine,
yeah.
to become a giant fucking novelist, you know, and the New York Times bestseller and conquer the world with, you know, three books, you know, we would have to be allowed to take that shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were really open to that. And it was just a matter of being able to sort of separate those two worlds and always have to make it fundamentally clear. I can no longer help you in comics if I'm writing a comic for you.
Right.
And if we're cool with our relationship, then great. And I then would have to, like, once I would write comics and then people start optioning comics, I was able to do less and less at Entertainment Weekly because there was always a conflict of interest. It was like, so, hey, Disney's going to option this comic book. I guess I cannot cover movies anymore. Like, okay, well, so now this option has shifted over to Disney TV. I guess I can't help you cover TV anymore. And it ultimately became, you just can't work here anymore. No, I can't.
Wow.
I remember, like, when I was in high school and college, I did a lot of sports journalism. I covered sports, and that was, you know, one thing I was really into, especially baseball. And the nice thing about covering sports is that I could never make that transition. Like, I was never going to, like, no one's going to be like, yeah, you know what? You've got the, you've got an arm, kid. We're going to draft you. That was never, like, an option. But, like, now that I'm doing this, there's always that, like, you know, prospect that, oh, I'm writing a thing on the side, and, you know, one day, I mean, I like to make short films for fun, but it's that tantalizing idea that doesn't come with a lot of other, I think, journalism professions.
Mm.
Yeah. Although, I would watch the movie of the sports writer who gets drafted to, like, you know, the Cleveland Indians.
Me too, actually.
Or I'd love to see, like, a sports writer play basketball. I think those are the most incongruous things.
Even better.
Yeah.
Even better.
Yeah, that would be messy. And sports writers are not known for their athleticism, especially.
No.
Like the least athletic people possible covering sports.
What's up with that?
Yeah, it's. I think it's just like, I don't know, they just travel and sit on their ass watching sports all day, so that's what ends up happening.
Yeah.
Mark,
take a walk, guys.
No. Right, exactly.
Speaking of being a fan and a reader, when was the last time you were blown away by a comic book that you weren't on?
I will candidly admit, somewhat shamefully admit, mm-hmm. that my comics reading has atrophied over the last couple of years. Like, it is both a mixture of lack of available free time, mm-hmm. and the sort of philosophical shift between output mode and intake mode.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. it's like, if you're, you know, for the last couple of years, there's been a lot of I'm creating, and it's always hard while in the process of creating stuff, of building stuff, to also be like, I'm going to sit down and read all of the comic books now. Mm-hmm. Like, I kind of don't want that stuff in my brain while I'm trying to put stuff, you know, hopefully into the world.
Yeah.
And then some of it is just like, it's a habit that I've fallen out of, and I feel incredibly badly that I've fallen out of it. So whenever I think back on, you know, the moments that I've loved in comics, the moments that just blew me away, they're always like, you know, sort of older books from I'm not even going to say childhood because that's not the right time, but, you know, reading stuff like Why the Last Man and stuff like Sandman, yeah. and stuff like Walking Dead, mm-hmm. and just watching how these serialized stories just build and build and build and then knock out your knees from under you and take your breath away.
Yeah.
You know, like there's a reason why those guys ended up writing TV, you know, like I, you know, and I've heard the story that Damon Lindelof was a huge fan of Why the Last Man and was like, find me Brian Vaughn, because that dude knows how to write TV.
Unbelievable.
Even if he doesn't know how to write TV.
Yeah.
You know, was like, all of these books are cliffhangers. They're all character pieces with cliffhangers and amazing narrative twists. And this dude should absolutely be able to write Lost. And could, clearly.
Yeah, his dialogue is just, like, tremendous. You know it when you read it, who he is.
Like he, you know, and even, like, reading a book like Saga, which is defiantly unadaptable, but, you know, all of his gifts are at work, and they're all manifest, and it's all like, oh, no, I get it. This guy is friggin' brilliant in a way that makes me sad, because I'm not.
It's also tough. It's also tough, like, there's only so much free time, and I'm in, you know, I think Emily and I both, we produce so much, just whether it's work on our own or work for our jobs, that it's tough to just switch into full-on watching or intake mode.
Yeah.
Just physically difficult to do that.
Yeah, I mean, and then I feel guilty.
Yes.
You know, it's like, okay, so here I am working, you know, 9 to 5 if I'm lucky, you know, and then I get home, and hey, I've got a family, and they're going to want some time, and hey, so it's after that, and okay, so there's stuff that I got to write for myself, and I got to do that now. And then which of those things am I going to sacrifice to spend 2 hours reading comics? And I have yet to figure out the equation that allows me that kind of free time. And I wish I could, because, you know, being independently wealthy would just leave me more time to read comic books. But sadly, I am not independently wealthy. Maybe I should marry rich. Like, honey, I'm sorry. I have to leave you. I need to marry rich so I can read comics. But
I mean, it's reasonable, you know.
You know what you want.
I don't think that's a conversation that will go well for any party concerned.
Well, yeah, I'm going to go home tonight and probably will get home up to like 9 o'clock or so. And I got a little work to do, but I also want to watch a movie screener I have. And I'm already stressed over like, do I do work? Do I watch a screener? Do I like text with friends? What?
Like text, not see them.
Yeah. Oh yeah, just text. Yeah, just text. I couldn't go as far as seeing them. That'd be too much.
Yeah,
that's too much.
We have too many options of too many things to do.
Oh my god!
Whereas
yeah.
when you're 12 or 13 or 15 or even 17, it's what am I doing today? I don't have a job. You know, I'm hanging out with my friends. But when I'm not hanging with my friends, I did my homework. I'm just going to sit here and read this stack of comics, and that'll be an afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that afternoon anymore.
The amount of time...
I just loathe myself a little bit for it.
Yeah.
The amount of time I spent playing the computer game Civilization 2.
Oh, that, I play Civ 5.
Like, that, it's insane, the amount of time I spent playing that game, and, like, I had nothing else to do, I guess, you know, when I was, like, 12.
I didn't know that. Huh.
Yeah.
Emily, I will appreciate that incredibly subtle dig. I play Civ 2. Yeah, I play Civ 5.
Because I'm with the times. No, I mean, maybe it's more sad that I spend that much. Like, when I want to turn my brain off and I should meditate, but I don't. I play Civ.
I play like Candy Crush.
You know, whatever gets you in the zone.
Yeah.
And so what are you working on now? I know that, you know, you've got a lot of balls in the air. I guess this plates spinning.
Plates in the air.
Plates
yeah.
in the air. You got balls juggling.
Yeah.
Ball juggling.
Yeah, I don't know.
Balls. Yeah.
I don't know.
Pins in the air. Flaming pins.
they're not flaming yet, but we'll get there, I'm sure. You know, there's a lot of kind of, you know, the stuff that I cannot talk about.
Sure.
Because they're in various stages of things happening and, you know, good plates and plates are good, but Castle Rock. Yeah. It's, you know, I am not active on Castle Rock right now. Like the room wrapped up, you know, in last fall.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it's like looking at cuts of episodes and giving notes on that sort of thing and not being overwhelmingly present on it, but still keeping tabs on it. Excuse me. You know, there's writing for myself. There's a little bit of freelancery for places like The Sci-Fi Wire and Hollywood Reporter.
Going to watch a lot of Marvel movies.
I'm going to watch a lot of friggin' Marvel movies. Yeah, I'm limbering up for that.
I'm excited.
Wow.
I need to train Creed style to be able to sit through 29 hours of Marvel movies.
We're going to have to get you like a butler or something for food and whatnot. Be part of it.
For a second, I thought you said... You were going to say, we're going to have to get you a bucket, which is also fair.
Either one. Your call. Look, whatever makes you comfortable.
This is my bucket. It's a multi-purpose bucket. Don't get too close to the bucket. You don't want a piece of this bucket. It's going to ride with me all night long.
Well, whatever you got to do. I mean, you'll have a roadie yourself, I think.
Yeah, no kidding. But yeah, so it's writing a bunch of stuff. It's again, like getting the new ready. You know, for as much work as one does to, like, get the job that you got, and, hey, awesome, mm-hmm. this pilot got me this gig. The next gig will require a new thing. You know, like, the time spent not in a room should be spent arming yourself to get back in a room. So that's kind of what the winter has been for me. And then, you know, podcasting with Kevin Smith, which, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not going to say it's a massive time suck, because, you know, it is the easiest show in the world to do. Because Kevin is the most amazing conversationalist in the world. So, what do you want to talk about, Kev? 2 hours later, we talked about it. Yay!
God, he was big. I grew up in Jersey, and Emily doesn't want to admit it, but she grew up there too.
yeah.
What a formative, his movies were, so especially growing up in the 90s in New Jersey, like the most formative things in the world. It was like, wow, you can talk like that in a movie. You know, like people can just say the shit that they say at 7-Eleven and then can be in a movie. I mean, he's much funnier than people I knew at 7-Eleven, but you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. I mean, and the dude absolutely has a foundational place in 20th century cinema. You know, mm-hmm. like the 90s indie boom was very much, he's at the front of that. Like he's at the rising crest of the beginning of independent cinema. And he is also the sweetest guy about that legacy. You know, it's always kind of wonderful to meet somebody who both appreciates and understands who he is and where he's from and what he does. And is also like, listen, I'm good at this, you know, while still not being a dick about it. You know, it's the rare person I found. And like, I remember I interviewed Lin Miranda for the LA Times. And so I got to spend like 90 minutes at lunch with him.
Wow.
And I've never seen somebody who wore genius quite so lightly. Mm. You know, like, he knows he's good at this.
Right.
You know, there's no way to have, you know, Hamilton happen to you and not be able to internalize it and recognize it and embrace it. And like, I'm good at this job. I am really good at this job. It's the thing that I'm the best at, and I'm pretty good at it. But he never uses, they never like bludgeons you over the head with that. He never, you know, makes you feel any less than because he is more than, because he's totally more than. He could be an asshole if he wanted to.
Yeah. I can't even, I can't even like begin to relate to that, but I wonder if people, because you know, people who are, I don't know, I feel like successful people are always afraid it's going to go away. Like the next time it's not going to be as good. Do you think that's part of it, or are they just really well adjusted?
You know, I mean, I think that some of it also comes through repetition, you know, be like, you know, Kev has made, you know, a dozen movies, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, some of them are good, some of them are bad. Some of them are among the best of their form. You know, some of them are legit classics, mm-hmm. but the ability to like, I can do this again, you know, like, you know, Lin has written two shows, both of them won Tonys. And it's like, you know what? I can do this more than once. I am not just a fluke.
Right.
And there's a confidence, and once you sort of embrace that confidence, there's an ease to it.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, no, okay, this is my job. I also happen to love my job, and I'm also really good at it. They pay me to do a thing that I love. You know, Kev once told me, he's like, man, that's the key to happiness. Like, find out what you love, and then find out how to get people to pay you to do it. And then if you can crack those two things, you will never be unhappy.
That's the dream.
I guess technically I do get paid to watch Godzilla movies, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's something.
Like, who knew? Who the hell knew, you know, 20 years ago that this would be a life you could lead?
Yeah.
That this would be like, what do you do? I play video games. I read comics. I write comics. I watch movies and TV, and they're paying me to do these things.
Mind blowing. It really is mind blowing.
So my dad still doesn't understand it. My dad is still like, I don't get it, but all right. Like, you bought a house, I suppose. So. Sure.
How is Kevin doing after his scare?
He is surprisingly great. Or maybe not that surprising, given that, you know, his heart is now getting more blood. His brain is now getting more oxygen mm-hmm. than it's gotten in a decade.
Huh.
So, like, you know, when I saw him, like, you know, 2 or 3 days afterwards when he first came home, I was like, how are you doing? He's like, man, I feel euphoric. And, like, yes, some of it is surviving a brush with death, but also some of it is just physical.
Yeah.
My heart is doing what it's supposed to do in a way it hasn't done in years and years and years. And, you know, and also the emotional sort of levity, the buoyness of the world rallying around him for a second. It's like, yeah, I got to live through my own wake.
Wow.
That's
and
true.
It was wonderful. And, you know, again, I was at peace with it. And so now that I, you know, get to have another bite of the apple, like, this is all, like, every day is a gift. It always was, but now, you know, doubly so.
God, that's wild.
You know, I relate to the all of a sudden you feel better and your brain's working better because you're actually have the heart working. I had heart surgery when I was in a few of them, but I had one when I was 15 or 16. I was almost 16. And,
oh, wow.
So, I mean, I had it fixed when I was really little, like 5 weeks old, but there was still, it was like the 80s, so they couldn't fully fix it. So I had, you know, I always had a thing with an aortic valve. And then I had heart surgery when I was a smaller kid. I had heart surgery when I'm 16. I grew like 5 inches in the next like year because I could actually grow. It was insane.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was a healthier kid overall. I was fine, but I was just a small kid. And then I just grew. I was like, holy shit, I can grow and like play sports. Oh my God. So luckily I didn't have the scare that he did. I mean, I can't compare it that way, but I definitely get that like, oh, actually, this traumatic moment actually made me, like, literally healthier, even though it sounds terrible.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, his outlook is fantastic. His recovery has been incredibly, like, the trying to slow him down proved a little difficult. I remember, like, you know, he has his heart attack, and his producing partner was like, all right, so we're canceling a bunch of shows, letting him recuperate. All right, man, whatever you say. And then, like, a day later, I get a text like, yeah, no, we're gonna put some of those shows back on the books. Like, Kev wants to go to work, and if going to work is standing there and talking for 2 hours, that's okay.
Yeah,
cool.
Well, it's nice, that's, you know, okay. when you have that kind of scare, you want to get back at it right away.
If you're an artist, like, yeah. He is, yeah.
Yeah, cool. Like, it's, you know, he has a ton of fun doing it, and why not have fun if you can? Mm. And if it doesn't hurt anybody, including yourself, then go for it.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Mark, this has been awesome. Thank you for taking the time and pulling over during the rainstorm in California.
Yes. No, I mean, I'm glad we finally got to hook this up. We've been trying for a while,
yeah.
and schedules have finally agreed to mesh on our behalf.
Thank you so much, man. So how can people, I mean, listen, everyone who listens to this is going to know where to find you on Twitter, because they probably would have gotten it from your Twitter,
yeah.
right? Let's be honest. You're way more popular than we are. But for the people who... For my four followers that, I'm kidding, but for people who want to find you on Twitter and on the internet, how do they find you?
On the Twitters, I am at Mark Bernardin with a C, all one word, Bernardin, same thing on Instagram. Tumblr, I don't even use it anymore because it's a weird, you know, it's like walking through a forest of like incredibly sad journals and awful porn. And if you just step off the path, and just wander slightly, like, oh, God, that's a thing I didn't need to see. Or, oh, man, I'm so sad now.
Yeah. And it's like a half-dead forest, too.
Oh, my God.
It's a half-dead forest. Yeah, and like, I don't need to be. Or it's a forest of dicks. And then I'm like, I don't need to see a forest of dicks either.
It would be something.
So, great. And then on the Facebook, Mark Bernardin Official, I think, is that page over there.
Cool.
For as long as anybody's still on Facebook.
Right.
I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. If only we weren't relying on it.
Yeah.
Damn, Zuckerberg.
I know. If only, like, my mom didn't want to see pictures of the kids, I would be gone.
People having interest in my life is too much for me.
Yeah. Don't need it. Don't want it. Go away.
All right, Mark. Thank you so much. Good luck with the TV season. I'm sure we will see you on the credits of a bunch of shows coming up.
Knock on wood, guys. Thank you very much. This was fun.